The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On our last program, we were reading from the November 2020 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and we began an article titled The Redemption of Rosa Bonheur by Elaine Sciolino. She was an international superstar, and then she was ignored. Now one family is working fervently to restore the forgotten artist to greatness. The Empress Eugenie of France declared genius has no sex in regard to Rosa Bonheur. And Catherine Brault is a French woman, a former communications specialist, bought the chateau in 2017. She said it was her mission to restore her to the greatness she deserves. We'll pick up where we left off. Leading visitors on a recent tour of the chateau, Lou Brault, Catherine's 26-year-old daughter, answered questions about Bonheur's art and life and why she fell out of favor. She said Bonheur had not supported a painting school or aligned herself with any artistic movement, such as the Barbizon landscape painters, who also worked in the Fontainebleau forest. Bonheur was also eclipsed by Impressionism. Paul Cézanne savaged her painting Plowing in the Nivernais, saying it is horribly like the real thing. I always get a question about her sexuality, Lou Brault said, and I respond, it's not so easy to say. There are doubts. The French Ministry of Culture takes a definitive stance on the subject. Its entry on Bonheur says, if today her work has fallen into oblivion, she is remembered as one of the figures of the homosexual and feminist cause. When France went into lockdown during the early stages of the pandemic, Brault transformed months of confinement into a treasure hunt. She told me that the four attics on two floors became an obsession. Clutter lined the floors. Dust choked the air. She threw out debris, opened boxes, sifted through heavy cardboard portfolios, lined up frame drawings and engravings leaning haphazardly against the walls. I went in day after day, losing track of time, not even stopping to eat or drink, she said. She donned a miner's lamp so she could work in the attics at night. During my visit, Brault and I mounted narrow staircases and entered the unlit spaces, which smelled of decades of dust. She showed me some of the treasures she had uncovered: paintings, sketches, auction catalogs, news clippings, books, notebooks, account records, photographs, letters and other writings, plus bits of lace, embroidered ribbon, and decorative buttons from Bonheur's clothing. She opened a box to reveal an enormous white, realistically detailed plaster head of a lioness sculpted by Bonheur. One scrapbook was filled with dozens of Bonheur's humorous caricatures, so unlike the earnest and realistic animal paintings that they feel as if they could have been drawn today. Another box contained a study for a landscape painted on wood. Still another, a pencil portrait of Bonheur's mother. Brault showed me a pile of drawings of donkeys and sheep found under a stack of china plates. In an adjoining room, cardboard boxes were filled with envelopes holding thousands of glass photo plates, awaiting identification and organization. Passionate about early experiments with photography, Bonheur had built a darkroom for herself. Brault estimates that there are more than 50,000 works of art, objects, and documents in the chateau. She has dedicated two rooms to studying and archiving the old and the newly discovered works. Scholars and art historians have been invited to visit and work in the archives. A new edition of Klumpke's autobiography of Bonheur and a catalogue raisonné that will list all of her works are underway. Twice a week, Michel Pons, a self-taught historian who lives nearby, comes in to work on the archives. He recently published a short illustrated book on the genesis of the horse fair, incorporating the studies and sketches found at the chateau. We are seeking patrons to help us develop conservation areas, archive consultation rooms, and residences for researchers, said Brault. Last year, the Musée d'Orsay featured a small exhibition of Bollner's little-known caricatures. Isolde Pludermacher, chief curator of paintings at the museum, told me she is seeing signs of renewed interest in Bollner's work. We are discovering new things about her that have so much resonance today, she said. It's time to study her in a new light. Rosa Bonheur is being reborn, says Lou Brault. She is finally coming out of the purgatory into which she was unjustly thrown. Her mother takes me back to the atelier. I was all alone, cleaning out the attics one day, and I found this, she says, holding a 10-foot-long roll of heavy paper. She lays it on the floor and slowly unrolls it. It is a preparatory work in charcoal, featuring a man on a rearing horse and a very unusual figure for Bonheur, a woman smack in the center on horseback, riding so fast that the scarf covering her hair blows in the wind. I am one of the first outsiders to see it. It took my breath away, says Brault. I was like an excited child. I yelled for my daughters to come quick, Lou says. We were screaming with joy. Brault has one more thing to show me. A photograph of Bollner seated in her artist's smock and pants. She's holding a large white teacup in her hands, one of the teacups that sits in the cabinet in her study. My daughters and I are tea drinkers, and suddenly it brought her into our family, says Brault. She made her presence known. I sometimes have the impression that she's talking to me. I hear her voice telling me, try harder. You haven't tried hard enough. Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section of Smithsonian Magazine titled You're So Vain by Clive Thompson. Today's obsession with selfies had a surprising mirror image centuries ago. Barry and Marlene Bogle run a farm in southern Ontario, and each summer they produce about 1.6 million shoulder-high sunflowers. It's a gorgeous sight. So in 2018, the Bogles decided to open a side business, charging $7.50 per adult to visit the farm and take photographs among the blooms. Young women came in droves to pose for selfies and sundresses, bearded men in sunglasses with snapshots of their faces poking cheekily out of the crops. It quickly spun out of control. Soon, thousands of visitors were arriving each day, trampling the crops as they sought the perfect selfie. Their cars clogged nearby roads, causing accidents. One car door was ripped off. It soon became clear to the Bogles that many of these smiling visitors were coming not to see the flowers, but to see themselves. I can only describe it as like a zombie apocalypse, the Bogle's son Brad, who works on the farm, told Canada's Globe and Mail. The Bogles canceled the selfie-taking business after just 8 days. 2 years later, hopeful picture seekers still visit, only to be turned away before they can ruin the flowers. These days, selfies often get a bad rap. When you consider the fate of the Bogles, it's not hard to see why. Pundits blame them for creating an upswell of self-regard, a culture where everyone is constantly primping for the camera and focusing on themselves while ignoring the world around them. Some academic research supports the dim view. One study published in October 2019 found that the highest levels of selfie-taking correlated with grandiose narcissism, an inflated sense of self. And famous models keep ratcheting up the pressure. Recently, Instagram superstars including Kylie Jenner and Emily Ratajkowski began sharing multi-selfies, in which they posed several snaps of themselves in nearly the exact same pose. The multi-selfie expresses a first-world problem of the highest order. Essentially, you cannot decide which of your marginally different, equally vain pictures to post, so you post all of them. The journalist Phoebe Luckhurst wrote in an article about the trend. Defenders, on the other hand, argue that selfies are a perfectly healthy way of exploring who we are. Still, it shouldn't be surprising that the selfie arouses such passions. Similar anxieties and enthusiasm stirred hundreds of years ago when the original tool for self-scrutiny emerged in its modern form, the mirror. Judging by the archaeological record, we've been fascinated by our reflections for a long time. Some of the earliest human-made mirrors, fashioned from polished obsidian, date to 6,200 BC in Turkey. Egyptians later made mirrors of polished copper, and Chinese inventors from reflective jade. Mirrors were sometimes involved in religious observance, regarded as a portal to a spiritual world. But even back then, mirrors were largely used to assess how gorgeous we were. Egyptian paintings and carvings show the upper classes combing their hair and applying thick red, green, yellow, and black cosmetics in front of mirrors. Later, the Greeks and Romans developed small glass mirrors, and their ability to critique and print became even more precise. Men began curling their hair and fretted about baldness. Romans would even use mirrors to look at themselves having orgies, says Mark Pendergrast, author of Mirror, Mirror. With all this sex and primping, mirrors were associated from early on with vanity and self-obsession, particularly in women. During the medieval period in Europe, paintings of vice would include women gazing into hand mirrors while the skeletons of demons lurked behind them. Through the Middle Ages, the technology for mirrors was crude. Fashioned from blown glass, they were usually small and often convex. In the Renaissance, Italians began developing techniques to make flatter glass, and in 1507 hit upon a combo of covering the back of the glass with mercury and tin to produce startlingly clear mirrors. This new technology was enthralling, but so expensive that nobles sometimes sold property just to afford one. "I had some wretched land which bought me nothing but wheat," as one countess said in the account by the early 19th century philosopher Henri de Saint-Simon. "So I sold it and bought this fine mirror." In the 16th and 17th centuries, mirror making was so costly that it required the investment of half of France's GDP. By the time the Renaissance was in full flower, wealthy noblemen could procure mirrors so large they could regard their entire body at a glance. It was a transformative sight. The historian Ian Mortimer believes that mirrors were central in developing the modern sense of primacy of the individual over the community. "Mankind," Mortimer tells me, "became a valid topic of study in its own right. He knows he's no longer seen through the lens of God's creation." Wealthy merchants and nobles began to commission more and more portraits. Fashion became an even sharper obsession. As the playwright and novelist Louis-Sébastien Mercier noted in the 1780s, wealthy young men would peer in four mirrors at once to see if their breeches are tight against their skin, a sort of multi-selfie before its time. In 1715, the essayist Richard Steele observed throngs flocking to a London mirror shop, where people will certainly be well pleased, for they will have unavoidable opportunities of seeing what they most like, I mean their own dear selves. Wealthy Europeans became increasingly obsessed with how they appeared to each other, and the well-off would spend hours practicing their smiles and physical poses in the mirror. Many devout Christians, including American Puritans, sniffed at all this self-regard. In the early years of America, mirrors were considered, within American society, a very suspect class of objects, a kind of luxury that was somewhat shameful, says Josiah McElhaney, a Brooklyn-based artist who works with mirrors. Some countries levy taxes on large mirrors. America's mirror taxes were so high that if a furniture maker wished to create a full-body-sized reflection without going bankrupt, he had to assemble it from several smaller mirrors. It wasn't until the last decades of the 19th century that the industrial world could finally make big mirrors cheaply. Production exploded, and mirrors quickly passed from extravagances for the rich to everyday devices that were affordable among the emerging middle class. In 1897, Sears Roebuck advertised 10-inch square mirrors for only 50 cents apiece, around $15 in today's money, and proclaimed, No house is complete without a number of small mirrors, which are handy in so many rooms. Suddenly, people of modest means could examine their appearance with the obsessiveness of a nobleman. They could even do it on the go. One hot commodity, mass-marketed in the early 20th century, was the compact mirror. Some were tricked out with add-ons like electric fans. In the roaring 20s, the business of cosmetics accelerated, propelled by a hunger for novelty and a flood of young single women entering the workforce, newly attentive to how they appeared. Women came to apply cosmetics ostentatiously, flicking open their compacts with a flourish at the dinner table or on a public bus. If we rouge our cheeks and powder our noses before every mirror we meet in public, there can be no turpitude in that, Dorothy Cox argued in her 1927 book, Etiquette of Beauty. Standards for everyday cosmetics were also heightened by movies, where professional lighting and the newfangled technique of the close-up, popularized in 1911, spurred increasingly nuanced movie star makeup. Equipped with modern mirrors that offered their own personal close-ups, women aimed to master those movie star looks themselves. Women's and men's use of cosmetics was professionalizing during this period, says Lisa Eldridge, a veteran makeup artist and author of Face Paint, The Story of Makeup. Max Factor, a cosmetics pioneer in the 1920s, urged women to stare into their mirrors at length to better understand what their natural look really was, and thus how to enhance it. Nature's work, Factor noted, is often incomplete. We were suddenly much more aware of our outer surfaces. Around the 1920s is where a woman's appearance is described as her look, says Margaret Mile Petty, executive director of entrepreneurship at the University of Technology, Sydney, whose academic work focuses on lighting and domestic interiors. And with a generation of men now peering into the mirror all day, beards, so prominent in Victorian times, essentially vanished in the first decades of the 20th century. A 1937 Pendergrass found, men spent as much money at barbershops as women spent in beauty parlors. By 1930, men's and women's cosmetics was a $2 billion a year industry. McElhaney argues that the mass use of mirrors is intertwined with Western culture's shift towards psychological thinking, the idea that a crucial life task is to peer into our emotions and hidden motivations. In the late 19th century, early 20th century, because of the concept of the mirror, you couldn't call yourself an up-to-date person or a modern person unless you have examined yourself, McElhaney says. In one sense, our smartphones, with all these selfies, are now our pocket mirrors, inspiring the same self-conscious anxieties that mirrors provoked. Yet taking a selfie is also different from peering into a mirror. The mirror is mostly private, but every time we pose for a selfie, we're aware of its potential for publicness, says Alicia Eller, author of The Selfie Generation. Just as compact mirrors did in the early 20th century, selfies on social media have propelled an explosion of technologies of self-presentation, from custom lights for taking self-portraits on your phone to photo-filtering software that airbrushes your appearance. You just look like you have this unbelievably professionally applied makeup and perfect skin, says Eldridge, the makeup artist. Yet when the filters are turned off, the high-resolution nature of today's phone can be even more brutally honest than a mirror, showing every tiny flaw. Eldridge worries that the self-enhanced self-scrutiny can be emotionally hard to bear. It's kind of crazy, interesting, almost warped psychologically, quite damaging, probably, time to be a young woman or man, she says. Psychologists are generally less fretful about selfies than other critics. Certainly, young people with pre-existing psychological issues can suffer under the pressure of incessant self-preservation, says Alexandra Hamlet, a clinical psychologist who works with preteens and teenagers at the Child Mind Institute in Manhattan. But for those who are generally in good mental health, copious selfie-taking can be part of the natural development. Children, teens get to try on different personae, Hamlet says, in a way that can be a little more healthy than going out and, you know, experimenting with drugs. Next, we'll move on to an Origins article titled All-Purpose Paisley by Laura Hilgers, How an Indian Export Became Part of the Fabric of American Life. Long before American cowboys sported bandanas, the European snuff user of the 18th century suffered from an embarrassing problem. Blowing his nose into a white or solid-colored handkerchief left behind dark tobacco stains. He found a stylish solution in India, where textile makers employed a millennium-old tie-dyeing technique called bandhani to create colorful silk and cotton kerchiefs covered in lively patterns. After the Dutch and English East India companies imported these kerchiefs to England, snuff takers embraced them to make their habit more discreet, and the name was anglicized to bandana. By the early 19th century, Europe had started producing its own bandanas, most notably in Mulhouse, France, where dye producers developed a version of turkey red, the color most commonly associated with bandanas today. The original dye was made of sheep dung, madder root, and olive oil, and applied to fabric through a process so complicated it inspired all sorts of industrial espionage, says Susan Brown, associate curator of textiles at the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Meeting. The familiar paisley pattern imitated cashmere shawls. In colonial America, bandanas were sometimes printed with maps as guide for travel. They also made a splash during the Revolutionary War. One bandana from a period featured a likeness of George Washington astride a horse, encircled by a series of cannons and the words, George Washington, Esquire, founder and protector of America's liberty and independency. Historians suspect that Martha Washington commissioned this cotton bandana, likely made in 1775 or 1776 by Philadelphia textile manufacturer John Hewson. Bandanas have appeared frequently in American politics ever since. Theodore Roosevelt's 1912 bandana included the words and music for his boisterous campaign song, We Want Teddy. The bandana for Adlai Stevenson's 1956 presidential campaign featured a smiling photo of the candidate and exhorted voters to go all the way with Adlai. Still beloved by cowboys and bandits, including a bank robber in Miami Lakes, Florida this January, bandanas today are used as handkerchief, neck covering, headscarf, or in COVID-19 times, face mask. They were largely meant for hard use, says Madeline Shaw, curator of the Smithsonian's National Museum of America History's Division of Cultural and Community Life. Despite their all-American status, the best-selling bandanas during the pandemic aren't red, white, or blue. They're black. We'll finish off today's episode with some more questions from Ask Smithsonian. You've got questions, we've got experts. My Quajalbaum from San Jose, California asks, why do different types of quarks have such whimsical, non-scientific sounding names like strange and charm? In some cases, they're aptly named, says Hossein Sadikpour, senior scientist at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory. These basic components of nuclear particles like protons and neutrons come in what scientists call six quote-unquote flavors: up, down, top, bottom, charm, and strange. When a particle in one experiment lasted longer than expected, scientists named the quark involved in the process strange. Charm quarks were named before they were even discovered, perhaps because their predicted behavior would make the scientists' theories work like a charm. Top and bottom quarks used to have whimsical names, too: truth and beauty. The word quark itself was inspired by a nonsense line from James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, three quarks for Muster Mark. And then John David Pratt from Glen Falls, New York asks, when and how did stamps start featuring famous Americans who weren't politicians? The first stamps, released in 1847, featured George Washington, the first president, and Benjamin Franklin, the first postmaster general. Designs gradually broadened, but it wasn't until the famous American series of 1940 that artists, scientists, and writers appeared in significant numbers, says Daniel Piazza, curator of Filetti at the National Postal Museum. In 1957, to keep up with requests, the post office formed a Citizen Stamps Advisory Committee. Composed of 10 to 15 citizens, it still exists today. Over 800 people have been featured on U.S. stamps, from Sacagawea to Andy Warhol. The living aren't officially allowed on stamps, but there have been a few exceptions, including Neil Armstrong, presumably the man inside the spacesuit on the first man on the moon stamp that came out in 1969. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.